welcome in. It's This Is Going Well, I think the show where no one's listening, no one cares, the show where every episode's the last episode, and today it's Bow Chicka Wow Wow. That's right, funks, everything to do with them. What to do when your friends are in funks, what to do when you're in a funk. We're going to get funky on Therapy Thursdays on a Wednesday with Gary Dierenfeld. But first, this. Yesterday, I provided you with a voicemail from a listener named Stephanie with very little context. It gave me such joy, I thought I'd do that again. This time, Stephanie called me about what's weird about her, or him, or just Stephanie.
Hello, I'm Stephanie, and one weird thing about me is I like to shave my head from the scalp to the middle of my hair from time to time and leave the rest and grow that out from time to time. I hope that's weird enough about me, and I hope you like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Oh, ice cream. Cold.
Delicious cookie dough. Now let's mosey on over to Therapy Thursdays on a Wednesday with Gary Dierenfeld and discuss funks.
I've been doing this for so many years. You just do it.
You just do it. You just jump in. Believe it or not, I started taping before you said that.
Perfect. I'm ready.
You were born ready. You came out of the womb with a microphone.
You know what it is? First of all, let me tell you, the first time I ever did public speaking, if you could call it that, theater arts, grade 10, and I had to do a skit with one other student, a girl, and there we were in front of the school, and I froze.
Yeah.
I literally froze, and the theater arts teacher, fabulous guy, was throwing lines to me, and I wasn't catching them. It was so embarrassing. But here I am today, I'm a public speaker, and the only difference, David, between then and now is practice.
Yes. Yes. It's time behind the wheel. I mean...
That's it.
Do you think that horrible experience made you want to improve? You know, you're sort of chasing that childhood dragon of, okay, this was so horrible, but as an adult, I get to control the narrative. I get to become a good public speaker, so I don't have to feel that way again.
Yes. And I also, you know, was in the band, stage band in high school. So there was a lot of performing with that. And so
what was your instrument? Wait, we gotta drill this one in. We gotta drill down into this one. What were you playing?
Saxophone, flute, and clarinet, lead alto.
All at the same time, which is wild because you just have one mouth.
That's pretty wicked, eh? And the cymbals between my knees. But the more you're in front of a group, the more you're performing, the more you ease into it, get comfortable with it. And at this point in my career, I've been interviewed on radio and television more than 600 times in my life. I had a television show, 65 episodes of Newlywed Nearly Dead. So, and I've done more than 600 workshops, you know, live in front of groups anywhere from 20 to about 1200. It's practice. I started from a place where I absolutely was terrified and I blew it.
Yep.
And you gotta, as the saying goes, kind of get back on that horse.
When you're doing TV like that, is it like doing the news where they just put so much makeup on you, it's horrible and you look so strange, but on camera you look normal, but in person you look terrifying?
Here's the funny thing. When I started with the television show, there was a makeup artist and I'd have my makeup done. By the end of the fourth season, there was no makeup artist. I put a little bit of powder to get the
shine off.
The shine off, and that was it. When I did television, when I started doing interviews on television, that goes back to the 1990s. Again, there was a professional makeup artist, and you were really done up. By the time I stopped doing television, oh, I'm guessing 2016, 17, somewhere in there. I still do it occasionally, but from a more regular basis, there had been so many cuts.
Yeah, I was going to say, this one anecdote television. About makeup is like a metaphor for how things are in media in Canada.
Yes, the makeup artist was long gone, and I didn't even bother with the damn powder. So yes, it's amazing how things have changed that way over time in TV.
My girlfriend Miranda wanted me to tell you, because I said I'm interviewing Gary today, it's that therapy segment. And she said, well, he's a garapist. And she's like, has he ever heard that one? And I said, no, not that to my knowledge.
No.
And
no.
She's like, well, you can give him that gift. You can tell him that he's Gary the garapist. Or is Gary he Fairy the garapist? I don't know. As it comes out of my mouth, I realize it wasn't the stroke of genius she thought it was and that I thought it was as well.
Listen, I've been called a lot of things. I mean, that's one of the more benign.
Scumbag, dirtbag, late for dinner. Oh, God.
Well, listen, the truth is, in my line of work, a lot of my work was with high conflict separated parents.
I can imagine people get upset over that stuff. Slightly over, you know, divorce lawyers the most likely to be murdered by their clients, not criminal defense lawyers. You could screw up a criminal trial and that criminal still is like, well, you tried your best. I'm going to jail, but you tried your best. I won't hold a grudge. But divorce lawyers, they're the most likely to be murdered by their clients. I know you're a therapist in this situation, so it's slightly different.
Hang on. I wasn't a therapist. I would be a mediator, an assessor, or an arbitrator. So I'm either greatly influencing the outcome of a judge's position or recommendations, or I'm making the decision. And when you have high conflict separated parents, you know that one is going to like the outcome and one is not going to like the outcome. And that makes the service provider the target of blame.
I remember complaining to my dad, who's never been divorced, but I remember complaining to him about my divorce many years ago. And I said, I'm unhappy about this, and she's unhappy about that, and we're in this. I'm unhappy, she's unhappy, I'm unhappy, she's
unhappy. If you're both unhappy, that could be a good outcome.
That's what my father said. Yes. He says a divorce where both parties are miserable is a fair and good divorce.
But sometimes, listen, you know, depending on the facts of the case, one parent may have the lion's share of time with the kids and the decision-making authority, and no one is ever satisfied if you get the short end of that stick.
Yeah, we didn't have kids or a house, so it was tough, and there was things to split up and this and that. I won't get into the details, but I can imagine with kids, it just adds that whole other layer.
So all of this to say, I've been called a lot worse.
Got it. Than a garapist.
That's it. A garapist, it kind of sounds cool. Maybe if someone else is called a garapist, they're saying that affectionately and as a compliment, as an homage to me. That's my ego talking.
It's funny. You've actually met my girlfriend the first time we ever worked together. I had this idea that we would do therapy on the radio live, which you did. It was fun. I mean, no dramatic things happened. She came on the show to complain that I was working on the show too much, and you mediated it. It was fun. I mean, how deep were we really going to go?
Right.
But it was fun. And so you actually met her and she remembers you. And I think she remembers you very fondly because it was a fun. Honestly, I think she was just happy that I was spending time with her that day, even though it was working on the show. I figured out a way to spend time with her and work on my old job at the same time. And you helped facilitate that. So thank you.
Always my pleasure.
Have you ever done that? I guess. Go ahead.
Therapy on the radio?
Well, therapy, I guess you've done it on TV, like live therapy on TV.
I got 65 episodes in the can. Absolutely.
Do you ever think to yourself, there's only so far I can go? These people need to go off camera right now. There's more serious stuff that if I touch on, I'd be irresponsible.
Well, the truth of the matter is, you get the arc of the show that the editors and the producers want, but behind the scenes, you have to know that there were some other more difficult conversations that I had with many of the people who are on the show.
I remember, I think you can still watch old episodes of that show. I'm not sure where to get them, though. Maybe YouTube is the best place?
There's very little online of that particular show. There are some YouTube things where people who have been on have posted their own stuff.
Okay, so like a super cut of an individual couple. So if you search newlyweds, nearly deads on YouTube, you can get certain couples, but not like the whole show.
Yes, correct.
Well, I remember watching newlywed, one. It was like a redheaded girl and some dark-haired, like, slick guy.
They were a riot.
They were a riot.
They were certainly quirky. And he was a scallywag. He was doing things deliberately to get her goat. That when she found out, it's like, what are you doing there? And he, okay, I'm gonna come clean with some of this. But they were just both quirky, and their quirkiness was their likability, actually. So
yeah, sometimes people are so awful. You're like, how could you be this way? And then you realize the reason they're on TV is because that makes good TV.
Yes. I remember one couple, actually more than one couple in 65. There were a couple of couples who wanted their 15 minutes of fame. And so they used the show as a vehicle for that, not because they really had the couple issues they were pretending to have.
Interesting. But, so they just like pretend fighted on camera to make a fuss, get some press.
Yeah. Yeah. They wanted their 15 minutes of fame. And you realize that as you're going through it.
I wonder if reality TV producers, there's got to be something missing there where they realize the negative impact that portraying the people on the show could
salacious.
Have on them.
I mean,
and they just don't care, or they don't, you know, and
listen, David, my show was by and large real reality, because not all reality shows are real. They can be tightly scripted. I remember one producer turned to me and said, here's what I want you to tell the couple, because it'll be good for the arc of the show. And I said, but that doesn't fit with what I'm working on with this couple. No, I don't take my words from you. My words are sincere and they come out of my mouth naturally. So I remember having that conversation, because there's different producers on different episodes throughout the 65, you know, series. So I had to set some boundaries actually from time to time with a producer or two, so that it was as real can get.
Okay. That's saying a lot for television. When we come back, we're going to get to the topic I wanted to discuss with you, pulling people out of funks. We're here with Gary Dierenfeld. Stay with me. Gary, welcome back to the show.
It is so much fun being, every time, it is so much fun being on with you, David.
I don't know what your angle is, but he wants something, ladies and gentlemen. That's how you, and you're going to get it. I'll give it to you. When you're nice to me, anything's possible. Here's something. When I'm in funks, depressive funks, procrastination funks, not motivated, having a bad week, having a bad month, having a bad quarter, hey, even having a bad year, I've struggled with this kind of thing in the past. I'm divorced. When I first separated from my ex, I was in a prolonged funk. You add drugs and alcohol into the mix, which I'm now sober from, but it was really bad. And I remember often having in my funk this thought, it's always going to be like this. I have no imagination for it getting better. I'm always going to feel this way. You sort of lose that. You have a failure of imagination for what getting out of the funk or enjoying yourself or being happy or not feeling this way would be. One tool I've developed to deal with that is when I'm up and when I'm having good times and when I'm experiencing successes and I'm happy and I feel fulfilled and like I have a sense of community, I kind of stop and I pause and I say, hey, on Monday, April the 15th, 2024, I felt good. And so the next time I'm in a funk and I say, I can't imagine what it would be like to get out of it, I know that I've been one in the past and I know that I got out of it. And so I just need to take a deep breath and weather the storm. And I'm kind of ranting, but I know what it's like to not want to be pulled out of a funk. But when your friends...
Or not being able to pull yourself out of a...
Yeah, or not being able. But when your friends and your family see this happening, all they want to do is help. And you're kind of refusing it. And so from the perspective of someone who's trying to help, how do you deal with someone who's not doing well? Maybe they don't want to look for a new job. Maybe they, if they're a bit younger, they don't want to apply to new schools. They flunked out or they're unhappy or... they want to take a break, or maybe they don't want to date anymore because they had a bad breakup. Whatever it is, how do you deal with someone who just kind of wants to stay low and is struggling to picture what it would be like if they were to get out of this?
Okay. So what an introduction.
Did I just lay a lot on you?
A thousand issues. A complexity. I won't say a thousand issues. That's exaggerating. You raised a complexity of issues. And you're using the word funk, and you're using it in synonymously at times with depression and sometimes with anxiety. And so, you know, when I kind of think of a funk, I personally tend to think of a more short-term feeling down, okay? The way you've used it, it can be more pervasive, more overwhelming, more long-term. So I just want to make some of those distinctions in terms of the introduction that you provided, talking about a funk, and we need to differentiate between some of those things. I want to talk to you about a personal experience. This dates back to the mid-1990s. I was given a phenomenal opportunity, and it was to develop a private brain injury rehabilitation program in Toronto. There was no budget. I could do whatever I wanted to do. How would I do it? Go about it. The proviso was I inherited some other professionals who I must work with, even though my role was to be the executive on this team. One of the persons that I had to work with had such a huge ego, and they envisioned the program revolving around themselves. And they would tell each person what they needed to do, when they needed to do it on each and every case. My vision was what we call an interdisciplinary or even a transdisciplinary team, where all the professionals are putting their minds together simultaneously and collaboratively coming up with a set of recommendations to serve the person. This individual, when it was time to purchase office equipment, I said, here's your budget, here's your budget, here's your budget. We all had the same budget. This person overspent their budget by about 400%.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, how am I going to deal with this person? They were considerably older than me. They had much higher degrees than I did. And I was coming in as almost the kid, even though I had the title. And I lost sleep. David, I did not sleep that night. This person overspent the budget, good 400%. What am I going to do? How am I going to confront this person? And I lost a second night's sleep. I lost a third night's sleep, literally anxious. Finally, by the fourth day, the answer comes to me, which was the same as the first day. I'm going to have to confront the person and send the stuff back.
What does this have to do with funks? I'm losing it.
Well,
here.
I was in an anxiety. I was overwhelmed. I was in that kind of funk because you used a lot of examples there. And you also used the point of earmarking the day that you felt good because you can go back to it.
Yes, that to me is such an important skill that I've learned.
Yes. So I lost this sleep, finally confronted the individual, told the individual, all this is going back, and I am buying your equipment.
What is it, just computer equipment?
Office equipment.
Office equipment.
A desk, you know.
This guy going to Herman Miller? I mean, what is he?
You have no idea. And this is a situation that repeated itself with this individual several times.
Did it sabotage the project?
Not totally. And I got it back on track. But every time I would have 2, 3, 4 nights, no sleep. And here's what went through my mind. I will never sleep again. In each of these situations, I'll never be able to sleep again.
There it is.
And that's where I'm getting to. And then finally, by the third or fourth time, I realized that even if I'm losing sleep now, I will sleep again. I will find a solution. And so the next time that it happened, because it was hard to control this person. So the next time that it happened, when I was losing sleep, rather than lying there fighting it, I got up and I did things. I wrote my reports. I you know, went into my records and did the record keeping I needed to catch on up on. I made use of that time. And so I, from then on, whenever I've been stressed, can't sleep, my go-to is use that time constructively so that I'm not pissed on top of anxious. And so it fits with what you said. You earmark those times where you've been successful, where you've been feeling good, where you've been, where when you are the antithesis to that, when you're overwhelmed, in a funk, depressed, or anxious, you can point and say, I got through it. These are the moments. And you build on those. You build on those. I call them islands of health, islands mm-hmm. of good. And what you come to see is for most people, not for everyone if it's, you know, that serious, but for most people, there's quite a lot of landing spots, quite a lot of islands that kind of string together and make a greater land space than ocean.
What is the therapy concept there? Being called integrated? Like you can...
Yes, yes. You wind up integrating that. I do want to be mindful that, again, some people's funks are mislabeled, that truly it is depression.
I think that's what I'm talking about. You know,
individuals, they will require, or if they will certainly benefit from seeing their physician and being prescribed a medication. And here's a difference that I've experienced between people who are anxious versus people who are depressed. If you tell someone who is anxious they could benefit from a medication, their anxiety next attaches to the medication and they scare themselves out of it. You tell somebody who's depressed they can benefit from a medication, they see it as the lifeline that it is and they grab onto it. So in some ways, it's more difficult to treat somebody with anxiety than it is depression, because the anxiety is actually one of the barriers to treatment.
That's interesting. I don't know. Back to like for you in those four nights where you couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
That thought of I'll never get a good night's sleep again. For me, when I'm depressed, not only is it, will I ever be happy again? It's this thinking, oh, I've never been happy before. And this is how it's always been. And so when I'm in those moments, I kind of like don't trust my senses. I trust the tools that I trust those islands, as you call it. I trust those times where I felt like this in the past and I know that I got out of it because I felt good. And it's also a lesson in gratitude, right? When things are going well for you, you can stop and be gracious and earmark those times. But when I'm in a real bad depressive mood where I'm feeling pretty self-loathing, I kind of just like don't trust my senses in the sense that I don't trust my brain when it says you're always going to feel like this.
Well, in fairness to you, depression is typically your emotions betraying you. Mm-hmm. You're caused to feel bad disproportionate to the triggering event, if there is a triggering event, and you overwhelm yourself. And so many people say, trust your gut, trust your gut. Sorry, when you're depressed and anxious, you actually can't trust your gut. That's where cognitive behavior therapy comes in. Because in cognitive behavior therapy, we like that the head is above the heart. So we're listening to, we're trying to control things with our thoughts appropriately and our mind versus our feelings. So you have this bad, overwhelming feeling and the mind has to intervene saying, that's my depression talking trash to me again. I have to rise above that. I have to look at this. I have to look at my journal where, you know, you have journaled on this date, I felt good. And on this other date, I felt good as well. So that's cognitive behavior therapy. We put thinking between feeling and doing.
Yeah. You put thinking between the impulsiveness that.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. Well,
and
I laid.
Look, this is how we, but if let's go to another point in your question to me, which is how do we help others?
Oh boy. You know what? Let's pause there and let's come back and answer that because we're going to take a break. I'm here with Gary Dierenfeld. Gary Dierenfeld. Okay. We were talking about funks. We were talking about long spells of depression that we observe in others who may not be interested or may not have the imagination to may not be interested in being told, oh, it's going to get better. And they may be suffering from their brains betraying them with a failure of imagination for what it would be like if they did feel better. Maybe they forget all the times that they felt bad and then good again. They just think that it's always going to be like this.
When you're in that funk, you are totally overwhelmed. You're in mud up to your ears.
So strategies for dealing with loved ones you're observing in that cycle.
Right. So if you're the loved one, you have to appreciate that the person in this funk or depression is literally overwhelmed. It's not something where you can expect them to, in a sense, pull them up by their own bootstraps. You have to appreciate they don't have bootstraps. I mean, they don't. And it's not something you can talk them out of. And here's the thing. The degree to which you typically try to talk someone out of a funk, the worse it actually gets for them. Because their view is, you don't understand, you don't get me. And by defending the funk, they work themselves further down the rabbit hole. So the good intention of talking someone out of it can backfire. Because of that, all we really want the loved one to do is to, quite frankly, sit quietly and provide a safe space for that person to feel whatever it is they're feeling. You don't have to like it, you don't have to validate it, but you have to be there. And just your presence is offering an, if you will, an anchoring opportunity. They can anchor to you. They can feel comfortable in your space, non-judgmental. And that allows them to feel and let some of those feelings hopefully just dissipate naturally over time, because they don't need to defend the feelings or themselves.
It's funny. It reminds me of when I was drinking a lot and my friends and loved ones and even my therapist at times were trying to intervene. And I basically said, you have to tolerate me doing this. Otherwise, yeah, I'm just going to cut you out. And so some people were just like, you're an idiot. You are, because I was mixing drugs and alcohol in an unhealthy way. And like, you're going to kill yourself and I don't want to be a part of it. And other people were just offering support and saying, look, I know you may be passed out tonight, but I'm there for you. And I don't know, those who were patient with me and actually helped a lot with my final decision to cut it out. I know it's a little bit of a different, it's a little bit of a tangent because I'm talking about drugs and alcohol, but this idea of offering support.
The concept is the same.
Non-judgmental support, where you're not demanding a change, you're just offering a lifeline.
Yes.
For me, was super helpful when I was in those moments that I wasn't really ready to make a change. And anyone who was demanding that I make a change, I would fight, basically.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, you don't get me. I'm going to prove to you just where I'm at and how this is. And we don't want that to happen. We don't want to inadvertently press a person further into their funk, depression, drugs, or alcohol. So just that you are human and being there, that presence is the lifeline.
Interesting. Just like your presence on this show is a lifeline for me.
Oh, thank you.
What if it is starting to get dangerous? Like in my example where you're worried about the health of the person, should they continue?
Well, look, and that's an excellent question. If the person is putting themselves at such a degree of risk that they can bring harm to themselves, that's where we may need an intervention. That's where we may help the person into the car and into the emergency room or a treatment center. There are some bottom lines to that. You don't want to see a person inadvertently up their risk such that they can be permanently injured or die.
Okay. Intervention. I kind of had one of those bringing back weird memories.
Oh my gosh.
No, it's okay. A friend of mine just spent all night with me drinking, actually, but not letting me pop pills and mix it with alcohol. And he just kind of like, I don't know, sat with me and really like put it in plain terms what I was doing. And I don't know, it just helped. Yeah.
David, given our discussion and your tremendous self-disclosure, I want to say to you that this conversation can be a triggering event for you. I'm open about these things all the time.
It's not just with you, but go on. Okay, go ahead.
And when I say a triggering event, I'm not sitting here worried that you're going to leave the show and go do some drugs and alcohol, but it can come out even in your dreams and your sleep. You can wind up having vivid recollections and awful dreams tonight on the basis of this discussion, as may some of the listeners.
Fine.
Okay. So I'm pointing that out to normalize that experience, so that if you or anyone else is triggered such that it brings back unpleasant recollections, dreams, memories, just know that can happen. It's normal. And all the things that we talked about in terms of remembering that maybe there's a journal with other circumstances that were pleasant, all those things can be used to get through those triggering events too.
Yeah, I've got a bit of a different mind in terms of how I analyze me oversharing, I guess is what people would call it. Okay. I'm pretty honest with myself that I want to drink. I want to pop pills. When I first quit these things, there was a lot of internalized shame. Like the fact that I have the impulse or the desire meant that I was somehow wrong. And so I would just kind of wouldn't talk about it, or talking about it would make me anxious. But I actually think it's okay for an alcoholic to say that I miss drinking all the time and I love drinking.
I think that's perfectly okay because it's so bloody realistic.
Yeah, it's much more honest to say I love drinking. It's one of my most favorite things. It has a destructive force on my life. I know what that's like. I've been down that road. I'm not going to do it. I think that's a much better way to go about it than saying, oh, I don't want to drink, or not discussing it. Now, I know this is slightly different. I'm talking about it at an intervention moment I had with a friend, but it's the same idea. I'm okay talking about these things because when I don't, I get more triggered when they come up, I guess. Mm-hmm. But not everyone's like me. For some people, letting sleeping dogs lie may actually be the best strategy. But that's where I'm coming from, and that's kind of my analysis of...
No, and I appreciate that. And there's a transparency and authenticity and honesty about that. And because you're not pushing bullshit down, then you get to manage it.
Yeah. Although I think for some people, there's just stuff that's just too painful and is triggering no matter what. And they're the best, and they're well adjusted, and they've gotten over substance abuse or whatever it is, whatever the big issue was in their life. And for them, letting it lie and not discussing it all the time, not salting the wound all the time, I think that's a fine way to deal with events, maybe after traumatic events.
People have to figure out what is going to work for them. I just didn't want to pass on mentioning that our conversation generally can be triggering for people and that it can affect them, and just to be mindful of that.
Yes, today, and I think things we've talked about in the past, for sure. So I think you're right to point it out.
Yeah, because I don't want anyone to leave this conversation. You may have learned something, but I also want you to leave this conversation here today with a sense of safety.
Yeah, I think safety's important, Gary.
I so appreciate you, man. You bring up some weighty things for discussion.
I feel like
appreciate it.
I feel like I brought up funks, and then in 3 minutes, I just like was like substance abuse, severe depression, anxiety, normal funks that people go through that last 4 days, funks that can last a year, funks that require professional and occasion. I kind of laid it all out, but I'm glad we picked it all apart.
Yeah.
Gary, thank you for your time. Spending time with you is but an oasis in the desert dystopia that is my life. So thank you for being here.
Happy to be that island.
Island. Okay, desert island. I don't know. All right, that's the show. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back tomorrow with more of whatever this is.